We are all aware of the basic principle of suggestion. Now, this is a type of influence in which the mind is invited or impelled to an uncritical acceptance of recommendation or belief or thought or idea which a therapist may feel to be necessary or helpful. By uncritical, we mean that the suggestion is not met by an analytical reaction. The person does not settle down to inquire in his own thinking as to whether these suggestions are rational, reasonable, demonstrable, or arise from any certainty, and it also refrains from permitting an argumentative reaction to arise within himself. Thus, the concept underlying suggestion is that it is an idea or a recommendation which, passing through the mind of the patient without obstruction, may become a factor in the subconscious life of the person. Now, the subject of suggestion opens a wide variety of speculations and thoughts. And a few of these we want to examine a little at this time. We know, for example, that most human beings are susceptible to suggestion of one kind or another. We also know that the greatest period of receptivity is childhood. This does not mean that the child is necessarily less argumentative, although it is true that the child has less mental certainty with which to oppose suggestion. What appears to be one of the factors is that with the child there is very little conflict of subjective reaction to suggestion. The child has no counter suggestion, which must be compensated, or which arise in conflict with the new suggestion factor. The child does not have a series of highly fixed opinions of its own. It does not have strong habit mechanisms in thinking. It is more or less in a formative period of development. And for these reasons, suggestion is particularly vivid, powerful, and long-enduring. As we grow older, we make a discovery that even the psychologist at the moment does not seem to fully comprehend. It is that there are two motions or two directions of energy in relation to the conditioning of the human being. One is the motion from the person outward into the world around him, part of his inevitable and instinctive effort to become dominant over his environment. He is constantly causing to move from himself fixations of defense mechanism, He is out aggressively using his energy over a sphere of influence which he hopes to dominate. Opposed to this motion is the pressure of conditions around him moving in upon himself. Whenever we move in upon a person with ideas of any kind, we move head-on against the tide of his own outward-moving consciousness. We find that we are swimming against the stream, and that ideas entering into him have a much more difficult time reaching into his life because they are met by this continual outpouring of his own energy, his own convictions, his own attitudes, his own beliefs, his own theories on innumerable subjects above which he may or may not have any very solid knowledge. We know, however, also that the adult can be affected by suggestion. We are not certain, however, that this effect is exactly what we expect or hope. We are all subject to suggestion continuously at this time because nearly all forms of industry, salesmanship, economics, and the professions have become aware of the psychological factor. Many of them are working strongly upon the basic belief in the reality of suggestion as a way of influencing the private or public mind. But we observe also that they are not always successful. Take, for example, experience with television and radio advertising. There can be no doubt that the frequent repetition of certain advertising does promote sales. This cannot be denied. The facts are available. It is also, however, not to be denied that when an advertiser ceases to advertise, for even a short time, his sales fall off. It means, therefore, that suggestion is not held as retentively in the mind as we might at first suppose. The first conclusion would be that it is submerged by the continuance of other suggestions. If a company advertising coffee ceases to advertise, other advertisers of coffee gain a peculiar advantage. They begin to have their suggestion enter into the mind of the viewer or listener, and he in turn comes to buy that coffee most immediately advertised. Another point, however, should also be borne in mind. If advertising becomes too objectionable, if it is too continuous and too blatant, if its pretensions are too unreasonable, or its advertising is in poor taste, it may result in a revulsion mechanism, and the presumed purchaser may buy almost any other product because he is angry or rebellious against having his mind over-influenced. This we observe quite frequently now, and probably we'll see more of in the not-too-distant future. Thus, broadly speaking, we have two points demonstrated by modern usage. First, the suggestion very rapidly ceases unless it is repeated. And that this repetition, if continued for 10 years, will not ensure that the purchaser will buy the product in the 11th year. The pressure of the suggestion, therefore, is tied to its immediacy. And if this ceases, the suggestion loses authority. I believe we will find this to be essentially true also in psychological suggestion therapy. The second point to be made is that over-suggestion creates rebellion, not only in the purchasing of products, but throughout life. Over-suggestion in some of our family problems we like to call nagging. And we are convinced that nagging ultimately produces no good. That the insistence upon the acceptance of ideas causes a reaction in ourselves in which we rise to defend the right of free choice, the right of personal determinism. We demand that we shall always have the privilege of accepting or rejecting any suggestion that is made to us. This right, which we have demonstrated from our earliest experience as human beings, proves conclusively that a suggestion will not overwhelm all of the faculties or elements of our natures and minds, that we will accept to varying degrees according to our temperament suggestion elements, but we will not generally go overboard. We will always hold this peculiar privilege of making up our own mind. The only way this can be more or less completely neutralized, at least temporarily, is through the use of hypnotic techniques or hypnotic drugs. Theoretically, these may temporarily overwhelm our ability to defend our rights of free choice. But even in this instance, we must bear in mind that the interior part of ourselves, from which our determination to be ourselves springs, will recover in due time its own awareness. And after the effect of the drug or the hypnosis has worn off, self-determinism will reassert itself. Thus, suggestion, which is contrary to any abiding conviction in our own nature, or is contrary to our right to express our own individuality and freedom of choice, any such suggestion is likely to be short-lived and to have very restricted results, because it is not receiving the support of our own consciousness. Another important thing we have gradually come to realize about suggestion is that the more complex our culture becomes, and the more insistent and nagging suggestions become, the less effect they have. We build against even the suggestion therapist a kind of psychic antibody. We find gradually that an immunity to suggestion arises within the patient. This immunity simply means that the method, the technique, the process has exhausted its usefulness. And whereas temporarily the uncritical attitude can be held and the patient can be kept in a certain state of acceptance, in time this passes. The physician is aware of this. The physician is aware, for example, that when he uses psychological techniques, particularly in the various types of traditional or conservative therapy, that he creates a certain immediate result, which is not lasting. The old days of the bread pill perhaps are becoming less and less remembered by the living, but they were great days of therapy, when 2 cents worth of medication would do $100 worth of good. Today it is the reverse. We get very little real comfort out of a $20 prescription. Nearly always, the doctor knows that the first remedies which he is able to provide will have more efficacy due to the fact that the patient is in a little more receptive mood. A person filled with hope, going to a physician well recommended, and receiving from this physician the assurance that his case can be successfully treated. This perhaps followed by a certain amount of practical therapy, receives a powerful suggestion. This suggestion may cause a rapid, almost miraculous improvement in the patient. But by degrees, this element of novelty, this acceptance without the critical mind, wears off. Symptoms come back, very slightly perhaps, but enough to disillusion the patient. And in 2 or 3 months, he establishes this immunity. And the power of the physician to help him on the level of psychology is comparatively lost. The same is true in advertising and in many patent medicines and in many famous cure-alls that have descended to us through time. The greatest and most important testimonials are by those who have had miraculous recoveries within the first 2 weeks. After 6 months, very few of these persons would write a testimonial. By that time, there are 9 other remedies in between. But just as surely as we can have all the symptoms described on the bottle by a certain negative suggestion, we also can in time find that these symptoms return. We can find that the claims of the remedy will offset the symptom for a while. Then gradually facts set in again. We're back in the same old trouble. Suggestion, being by its very nature impermanent, has limitations which the best therapist must recognize. It is a bridge, giving him an immediate receptivity on the part of his patient, but ultimately only proven value can keep that relationship strong, meaningful, and resultful. If this breaks down, then we have the patient who has lost faith in the physician. And under such conditions, even a truly adequate doctor can do very, very little. Suggestion is therefore both positive and negative. The oldest records that we have on some of these subjects come from the Greeks. And Aristotle has made much of the suggestion power of oratory. Here we are heading right into politics. The glib talker can not only shout us down, but shout our minds into a coma for a short time. We wildly applaud, we are deeply moved, then go home and the next day wonder why we made fools of ourselves. We are unable to rationally understand how we could have been so completely hoodwinked. Well, perhaps we were not actually hoodwinked. What we really mean was, how could we be so influenced away from our normal attitudes on these things? Perhaps our attitudes were wrong in the beginning. But by the next day, our wrong attitude is back in control of the situation. We have been overwhelmed, forced into an uncritical relationship with another person by their bombast, by their beautiful wording, by the force of their personality, and by the common applause of other people like ourselves, all under a common glamour. All this constitutes a powerful suggestion pattern. In the field of our sciences, suggestion occupies another interesting relationship. Suggestion comes to us frequently through books. It comes to us also in prevailing modes of thought and therapy. A school for the treating of an ailment comes suddenly into existence, supported by distinguished authority, or by a most persuasive expression of its principles and its therapeutic value. This school sweeps the country. Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of persons suffering from certain ailments receive a new lease on life. They really believe that now they have the answer. So they flock to the remedy. They do everything possible to take advantage of this collective conviction that help will come. 2 years later, the school has disappeared. It could not perform a miracle. Man wants miracles. It was unable to sustain, by its actual proven merit, the glamorous pretensions which had surrounded it. The hundreds of thousands of persons did not immediately recover. Comes disenchantment. The school is now regarded as a fraud. Everyone believes they have been hoodwinked. All their hopes have come to nothing. Very likely the school was not a fraud. But expecting, as we do, miraculous circumstances, we felt them for a time, and they so exaggerated our hopes that disillusionment was more tragic than it would have been had our hopes been more moderate. So again, the suggestion can play an unpleasant and sometimes tragic trick upon us. Many years ago, there wandered about this country a number of spiritual healers, mostly of the evangelical nature. These persons were devout. Most of them were probably sincere. A few were undoubtedly merely theatrical. But a good many honestly believed that through prayer and through the laying on of hands or some other simple religious ritual, that they were able to be a channel for the healing power of God. They were so persuasive by their own conviction that they did convince many others. And at that time, the reports of miraculous cures were numerous. Most persons, however, never followed through on these reports. Had they followed through, they would have made two very interesting discoveries. They would have realized that certain persons did recover and remained well. Certain other persons appeared to recover, remained improved for a week, a month, 2 or 3 months, and then relapsed back again into the old condition. Why this distinct difference? The only answer lies within the individual himself. The degree to which the suggestion was actually, internally accepted. The degree to which the person, through his own believing, was able to remain uncritical and was able to continue the intensity of his faith. Again, among those who were improved, a further division into two groups has to be made. Suggestion has an area of usefulness beyond which normally it cannot extend itself. Suggestion is usually a mental-emotional process. Mental, perhaps, on the level of its acceptance, which must be, as we said, uncritical, but emotional in the reaction which it set up, of hope, faith, and a great desire and willingness to experience benefit. If, therefore, the trouble in the beginning was in that part of the nature of man which could be reached and could be served by a new or improved consciousness toward life, it is quite conceivable that the remedy might prove relatively permanent. An example is a man who had remained for a number of years very much of an atheist, or at least a negative agnostic. A thought, you know, negative agnostic. Or other life. He was sick, and he attended one of these healing services of an evangelist. Under the pressure of seeing others help with ailments similar to his own, he temporarily put aside his skepticism, and because of his great and pressing need, he went down the sawdust trail and asked for help. He received it. He received it almost certainly as a psychological experience. He received it as an acceptance within himself. Under normal conditions, most of the persons whom he saw there also helped, soon relapsed back into their former condition. But the experience produced a certain change in this man's total attitude toward life. From the miracle of the moment, from the fact that he instantly experienced good, he was transformed almost immediately into a believer. His skepticism, his agnosticism, his cynical attitude toward religion was wonderfully dissipated by this experience through which he passed. He remained from that time on to the end of his life a devout person, deeply conscious of the power of religion in the life of man. Because of this, his symptoms did not return. He had changed not merely as the result of an immediate suggestion, but by means of the help offered by a suggestion. He was able to make a marked and important decision affecting his total consciousness. Under such conditions, the suggestion was the bridge which led him to a far more complete recovery. Such is the same problem at Lourdes or Saint-Anne-de-Beaupré or any of the great healing shrines of the Christian and non-Christian world. For in both spheres, spiritual healing is by no means an unusual phenomenon. Thus we have in suggestion a present help, and it takes on many of the aspects of ordinary medication. It is an optimistic physician indeed who affirms that his treatment cures the disease. Usually he is content if he can bring the body into a better state or a better condition to assert its own rules of health over the ailment. If, therefore, the physician can be an honest secretary of nature, if he can assist nature, he is content. Suggestion can also assist nature, but not if in its substance or essence it is contrary to nature. Suggestion then goes on into many fields of relative importance from a psychological standpoint, but we must cope with a number of these fields as we proceed to try to understand them better. A suggestion made by a person whom we do not respect will seldom have much influence. We must have some openness, and there are two ways in which openness comes. One, by respecting the source of the information, and the other is respecting the information itself. The power of Adolf Hitler to sway the German people was not, I think, because Germany universally respected or admired the man. Certainly that would be practically impossible, particularly for a country which had achieved the intellectual scientific level which Germany had attained. But Adolf Hitler was saying things that a great many Germans wanted to believe. And perhaps they did not want to believe them as excessively as he said them. But they certainly did realize or did accept that the things that he said conformed with their own feelings on a great many subjects. Let's take a homely example. If a very wise man comes and tells you that you are wrong, you may, through great respect for that man, be influenced or receive the suggestion to examine his remarks or even to accept his counsel. If a very foolish man comes and tells you that you are right, that man almost immediately rises in your estimation. You come to the conclusion that regardless of where he got the information, he is inspired. Thus we may react with openness of consciousness to the authority of the great or to good news, information which we desire to receive, which will support our prejudice or will give comfort to our opinion or will add something to our estimation of our own stature. In these ways, suggestions move in upon us and become powerful influences sometimes, even tragic ones, in the continuance of our affairs. History and experience tells us, however, that it is not common for us to find a person sufficiently, completely noble, completely acceptable, that we will be remain indefinitely uncritical to his advice or to his recommendation. After a time, we become inevitably aware of the humanity in our fellow man. We observe that he does things which we do not approve of. We observe that he is not always successful. And we begin to suspect that we are under glamour, that this person's advice may not be as good as at first we believed it to be. And as our faith in the person is diminished, it's the usefulness of the faith in our lives crumbles and falls. From a very ancient time, therefore, powerful advice, suitable to change the course of life, to change the history of nations, to provide the most powerful inducements to the modification of character, such advice had to have an authority. And this authority came ultimately to be vested not in man, but in God. The only being that we could not sufficiently fathom to unveil. The only power so great that it could not crumble before the onsets of time and change. The only strength so absolute that it could not be exhausted or fatigued by occurrences was the divine strength itself. Also, God was about the only concept of a being which could be all-knowing, not only about life and the world, but also about us. God was the only principle, energy, power, or form of consciousness that we could not deceive, or which could be sufficiently perfect so that its advice would be infallible. Thus, from the earliest time, religion has exercised the strongest collective suggestion power on man. And this suggestion, most of it now embodied within sacred books, remains for most persons a source of leadership, of guidance, or direction, which they can accept uncritically. In fact, religion at a reasonably early date wrote criticism out of itself. And for thousands of years, religions taught their followers not to question. Because if they questioned, the magic of believing fell apart. Today we have people who sort of ridicule this. They say, let's ask some very pointed questions and ask them now. Let's get this all straightened out. So they ask the question. They break the mysterious little magic pattern that faith set up in the remote past. They discover, after they have asked questions and debated largely with themselves in the name of God, that they are not struck dead with a thunderbolt, that God does not avenge himself upon anyone who asks questions. So they go blissfully on their way, feeling that they have unveiled the infinite. But deity has had its own quiet revenge in its own quiet way. These persons have lost the strength of believing. Something has been taken out of them. A virtue has passed from them. And as a result of that, they are rewarded for their critical attitude by a whole group of psychological plagues which have arisen simply from the individual no longer having a non-critical relationship with life. He is much more interested now in proving that his own thoughts are right. So he has his own thoughts. He proves them to his own satisfaction, and perhaps the satisfaction of some other people. And then he gets sick immediately and goes to a psychologist. He has paid a very great price for a very little ego satisfaction. In addition to these great suggestions that have thundered from the Mount of Sinai, that have been found in the Sermon on the Mount, or set forth in the Tripitakas of Buddha, in addition to these tremendous suggestions that remain apart from life, often in conflict with our everyday experience, yet still too strong for us to resist internally. We have, in addition, the early records of certain sanctified persons, prophets, messiahs, teachers, come from God. The course of time, the human limitations or imperfections of these teachers have been forgotten. We no longer remember the simple, ordinary circumstances that must have played a large part in the lives of these teachers. We remember them only as haloed, mysterious God-men, whose words also ring down through time, for they spoke with the authority of God. And those were the days when the judges judged in Israel. And those were the days when the early Christian mystics communed with the apostles and the disciples, set up the foundations of their faith. It is very difficult for us to be uncritical with the simple, ordinary facts of life. But it is also very difficult for us to be rationally critical of a miracle. Between us and these persons are centuries of silence. We no longer know them, or their descendants, or the descendants of these descendants. They remain only in the elaborate tapestry of our own subconscious devisement. We create images of them. We worship them. We regard them. We revere them. We hold them as something apart. When we read their words or hear others read their words, we achieve a state of uncritical acceptance. Acceptance based upon a whole series of psychological experiences. These words brought consolation to our fathers and to their fathers before them. They have been the guides of our race. Before these words, Washington knelt in prayer at Valley Forge. And in the presence of this consolation, Lincoln knelt in the White House. The men we honor, the men we regard as peculiarly noble, the men whose strength came from this uncritical acceptance of the power of God in the life of man. This, therefore, is the great suggestion. And nearly all the moral culture of our race, nearly all of what slender advancement we have achieved, whatever of good spurs us on to try to build a civilization out of the chaos of our own selfishness, whatever great inspiration and insight we have known, have come from the suggestion of these gods and their divine providence. Therefore, when we come down to our own little daily living, suggestion presents a series of rather interesting facts or elements. If our physician says to us, "I think you're hating yourself into trouble," we say, "Well, Dr. Jones, if you'd gone through what we've gone through, you would have hated yourself into trouble too." Jones probably will agree. But if Jones instead says to you, "My friend, remember those words, love thine enemies, and do good unto them that despitefully use you," he is stumped. Jones isn't speaking for himself. Jones is only telling us something against which we have almost no conscious resistance. Therefore, the skill of Dr. Jones may lie partly in his ability to quote Scripture. And I suspect that some of the failures of modern psychology have resulted from the fact that psychologists have not been good Bible students. In their intellectual emancipation, they have turned from the most powerful remedy that they have in the Western world. That is the authority of the suggestion which arises from the religious tradition of our people. For this men will die without asking why. For this they will live content in the hope of some future good. This suggestion is very, very vital to us in nearly all forms of therapy. Now the next suggestion that is very important to us is derived from this same religious source, namely that God is an ever-present help in time of trouble. We have a confidence, and this confidence is uncritical. If we wish to take the scientific problem and sit down and try to analyze how God answers prayer, we're lost. If we try to wonder what is happening on one side of the world while God is taking care of the other side of the world, we are also in a dilemma. It is like the small child's question as to how Santa Claus can be in so many places at one time. The moment we think we take on a critical relationship to knowledge, to fact, to all these things. And in that moment, we lock ourselves against the power of receiving suggestions. If, however, uncritically, we do take the action of the immediate availability of the fact of divine help, then this ancient conviction, which is in our blood, archetypal in our consciousness, against which our consciousness has no defense, because our own consciousness believes it is true. With this, we do not have to wrestle as Jacob wrestled with the angel. We do not have to argue these things. The moment we argue a religion, we defile it. But in this simple fact, we now have another suggestion factor that becomes important. If this suggestion is accompanied by some element or some factor which involves God or involves religion, its effectiveness, or its intensity at least, is magnified 100-fold. We are no longer able to bring against it the immediate adversity of our own thinking. Let us take a very simple example of this particular point. An individual has lived for a long time under the attitude that there is no justice in the world. Many people develop that gem of thinking as they proceed through the years. It rises from such convictions as the observation that nearly every wrong person is well treated, and that no matter how hard we labor, we are never rewarded. Nurse this for a while, and we have a nice, solid, negative fixation. So we take the attitude there is no justice in the world. A lawyer, a legislator, or a judge might be able to give us a considerable amount of intellectual insight and show that while there are mistakes, that the general trend of man is to try to be just, so we're still miserable. We may go to a psychologist who points out to us all the defects in our own reason, or perhaps allows us to unveil our soul and dump upon him and the whole environment all of these negative instincts which we have been nursing so long. He believes that if we can exhaust ourselves completely, if we can talk about the injustice of the universe until we're tired of hearing it ourselves, that maybe we'll change our conversation. This sometimes happens. But by the time we leave the doctor's office, we get his bill, and then we do not believe in the justice of the universe all over again. Actually, we have no real argument to prove that right must win. We see evidence of it. We observe how tyrants and despots nearly always come to a sorry end. We have moral instruction to that point. But we can say that we are descended from a group of fuddy-duddies as far as that is concerned. But if within ourselves we suddenly become intensely aware of the power of a divine principle, if we internally suddenly believe that God is in his heavens and all is right with the world, and this becomes a reality in ourselves, we then neutralize out of a common conviction the problem of our own particular misfit. We begin to sense that the trouble is not in the universe, but in ourselves. And then as we must instinctively defend God, if we are a believer, we can no longer assume that deity is unable to prevent evil or unminded to do so. We begin to have to argue with ourselves about this. And no matter how we argue, instinct forces us to let God win. So to the suggestion that is made, if we can add this authority of high conviction, we achieve a great deal. Now, philosophy is very much like religion in this respect. Religion makes good a reality. Philosophy makes good a fact. By philosophy, we take the type of mind that is critical and whittle down its criticism. By philosophy, we can take the individual with a whole quantity of objections, and we can meet his objections one by one. And if our philosophy is adequate, that is, if it is basic, we can finally force the individual, at least to the grudging assent, that this life is under laws and under rules and under principles, and that if he is a wise man, he will obey them. This suggestion, supported therefore by philosophical insight, may be almost as strong as religion. But it lacks the one thing that religion has, and that is the warmth of a vital participation in believing. It is the warmth of religion which experiences good, even while philosophy defines it. Now, theoretically, we are in a scientific age, and let us not forget for a moment that that age and its principles and its rules, its convictions, and its degree of insight, let us not for a moment assume that these are not powers of suggestion in our daily living. Ultimately, science undoubtedly will have to bestow powerful, positive a suggestion upon the mind of man in order to prevent man from utterly befuddling himself with scientific knowledge. Science must finally come to positive, basic suggestion based upon its own discoveries. And these suggestions must be therapeutically sound, or they will destroy man. Science, perhaps, can suggest to the outer part of man what religion and philosophy can convey to his inner life. But the end of scientific suggestion is that it must be valid because it can overcome or nullify the criticism in the person who is receiving scientific knowledge. Our modern system of education is based upon breaking down man's non-scientific ideas. This is a weakening situation, however. For actually, when we break